From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 9/11, the war on terror, possible war with Iraq, have made the Republicans untouchable, or so it would seem. They have the White House and the majority in Congress. They have the majority of state legislatures for the first time in 50 years. The latest Gallup poll shows that Bush has a 60% approval rating in spite of growing anti-war sentiment around the globe, while Democratic presidential candidates are left scrambling for a cause. But the GOP may have an Achilles heel, says Washington Post political reporter Thomas Edsel. When it comes to the question of morality, the same political untouchability in the short term could come back to haunt the Republicans in 2004 and beyond. The reality is that we live in a liberal blue America, Edsel says, and the danger for the Republicans is that they could push their conservative agenda a step too far, shifting the political balance just enough for the Democrats to slide back into power. We're talking this hour about the shifting political landscape of red and blue America and the conservative versus liberal agenda. Will Republicans be able to keep their power hold in Washington? Or will Democrats find a way to get it back? And will it be party positions on the economy or moral issues that could make the crucial difference in 2004? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Delaware, Ohio, is Thomas Edsel, political reporter with The Washington Post. His article in the most recent issue of The Atlantic Monthly is Blue Movie: The Morality Gap is Becoming the Key Variable in American Politics. Hi, Tom.
How are you doing?
Very well. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Gail. Hello, Tom.
How are you?
Here we are on one of our favorite topics. And that is politics and how it plays out. And, Tom, many of the political junkies I know, including me, who read your article, said, well, finally, you have found a new lens to look at politics in America. Describe what that is.
Really, it sort of is a residue from the sexual revolution of the 1960s now playing out in our politics and really shifting the balance, that people who take basically the liberal side on questions of sexual morality, from homosexuality to premarital sex, and who also are less religious and more secular, tend very strongly to be Democrats. And basically the trends in the country have been in that direction. The sexual revolution of the night, which began, say, in the 1960s, has increasingly become part of our culture, part of our television, part of the whole way of life. And insofar as that happens and sort of spreads, you see a growing blue America. And that process had been taking place really until 9/11, which significantly changed the political ballgame.
Now, describe what you mean by blue America as opposed to red America. Are you talking about those maps that we see on election night?
Yeah, really, it's on television, this whole notion of blue America and red America, where the blue states were the coastal states plus Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, some of the Midwest, whereas red America was sort of geographically the largest part of the state, much of the heartland, much of the South, all the states that Bush carried, with the swing states, places like Florida, and even Ohio, where things are in the balance. What you have are, though, when you look at why do people vote now, the questions of morality, lifestyle, gun ownership, how much you go to church, whether you believe in abortion rights or you're against abortion, all those issues have now become much more strong tells of how you're going to vote than your economic class, which used to be the defining factor. Basically, you used to have a Democratic Party that was oriented to the working class and a Republican Party that was oriented towards Main Street and Wall Street. Those economic divisions just they're still there, but they're just much weaker, and they're being replaced to some extent, to a large extent, by these moral and value issues.
Well, you say being, is it a little too soon to say that what matters more right now to voters are social issues rather than economic ones?
No, and economic issues rise up in importance, especially in times of recession. although you would think in this last election, 2002, things have been pretty bad economically, but the party in power did not pay a price. But in most elections, the economy can be a very powerful factor, especially, though, when it's going in a negative direction. When the economy is going upwards, it's less and less of a salient factor in elections.
And do you think that these issues are likely to remain at center stage over the long haul, or is this a temporary phenomenon?
No, I think people really do feel very strongly about these issues. People, there is a very large, the Republican Party in the late 90s damaged itself very badly by pursuing the whole impeachment investigation. But I would argue that that was really a litmus test for the whole sexual revolution and sexual tolerance. And not that one side approved of what Bill Clinton did and one side didn't approve, but much more, where do you stand on all these issues of sexual freedom, the whole gamut of from gay rights to should people be able to do in the privacy of their own home whatever they want to do as long as it doesn't harm others. That set of values, I think, has gained a lot of strength. And when they are seen as being attacked or threatened, that can be a strongly motivating force. And you saw it, for example, in the congressional elections of 1998, when the Republicans actually lost seats in the House at a time when under normal circumstances, they should have picked up seats.
But if, as you say, the Democrats, that this plays into their favor, then how do you explain the fact that Bush won in 2000 and the Republicans triumphed in 2002?
That's a good question. One, I would say that Al Gore did not know how to play, this is not really the best way to phrase it, but did not know how to play the sexual card. Bill Clinton knew and understood this intellectually and intuitively, and was a genius at playing all these issues from pre-impeachment, post-impeachment, Jennifer Flowers, all these various questions that came up about him. He was able to, in many ways, turn to his advantage. Al Gore is just, I don't know how to describe it, he's just not attuned to these issues in the least and did not know how to play them, did not know how to play a host of different issues. And he lost an election that, by any standard, was a Democrat's to win.
And, of course, many people will tell you that he didn't lose it at all, but that's a different topic for another time.
He won it by 500,000 votes, but in terms of the popular vote. The 2002 election, sexes and sexual issues are dominant factors, but war trumps sex, and the threat of to security trumps sexual issues. And Bush has been a master since 9/11. At dominating the whole war issue.
I want to ask Jack Beatty, though, to remind us what was happening to the Bush administration prior to September 11th.
Well, things weren't going so well. In fact, Bush, I've seen a poll, most recent poll I saw was Bush at 54% approval, and he was about there in August of September of 2001. And the reasons seemed to be pretty much the same reasons as today. The economy was in bad shape. His policies were construed and were even palpably favoring wealthier Americans and corporations. His attacks on the environment were not playing well with mainstream voters. And he was sort of being defined by his tax cut, which, as I say, was overwhelmingly tilted toward the wealthy. And then along came September 11th, and it not only changed the situation for him immediately, it also presidentialized him. He had not been presidentialized by the election, which was clouded, but he got his mandate then. That was the situation for him then. You know, I think this is very interesting the analysis and way to look at it, but I wonder if these issues as predictors weren't stronger in around the Clinton period than they are normally. That is, Clinton raised these issues partly by his conduct and partly by just what he symbolized, the 60s. And so that some of those referendums were, some of those elections were, you know, referenda on the 60s. What troubles me, though, is when the Democrats give up on moral issues, because, of course, this would work against their pitch. They're also giving up on moral language in general, on values in general, about the economy, for example. And I think that there's a terrible need to remoralize political discourse about the economy, about issues of fairness and justice. Those are moral issues. And a party that on the one hand says, well, we want to leave you alone, let you be private and have this modern morality or whatever you want to do, we're not going to pass any judgments. And then on the other hand, it can't muster, you know, it's almost like it's in contradiction to itself when it tries to sound the moral note about the economy, about fairness in America. And often, you know, even when the Democrats use the word fairness, Walter Mondale did in 84, studies show that many voters thought he means fairness to blacks. He doesn't mean fairness to us. And so the moral issues that surround the economy and the power in the economy and just the plutocratic excesses in the economy, the Democrats partly forfeit that, I think, because of their libertarian orientation on quote unquote moral issues.
Tom, you said
I don't really agree with Jack on that.
Okay.
Jack is a good friend and has been a great editor to me.
That's all right. You're still allowed not to agree with him. Go ahead.
But I think that taking I wouldn't call it libertarian, but a tolerant point of view is a moral stand to take. And it does not preclude or cloud taking a stand on economic fairness issues I don't see the contradiction that Jack sees.
Tom, I want to move on to another point. You said a moment ago that war trumps sex, and I'm wondering, don't Democratic prospects for 2004 depend a great deal on either how well or not a possible war goes?
They do, and not just the war, but also the war on terrorism and the whole that climate. The hard fact is that voters on issues of these various sexual issues tend to favor the Democrats, although it's a close fight. On issues of military security and who's better equipped to deal with the threat of foreign governments or to handle foreign conflicts, the Republican Party has a huge edge over the Democrats. The sense of the Democratic Party as being the party of the anti-war party, the party of anti-Vietnam, still hangs over, and people doubt whether the party has the capacity, and the party and its leaders have the capacity to deal with the sort of very difficult decisions of conducting war. Bush has a leg up on that. If things go sour on him, that's another matter. But at the moment, it's a very tough climate for Democrats.
You agree, Jack?
Oh, sure. And I think that that's part of the moral advantage I think the Republicans have. They seem to speak for the country. And there's a sort of identification with the patriotic surge that the war feeling evokes is a kind of remoralizing. Suddenly we're all in this together. And I think that does give them a decided edge on just this at this level of, you know, right and wrong and projection of values.
We're talking about the role of morality in American politics and the shifting landscape of red and blue America. What is the political reality in America? And how does the so-called morality gap factor in? If we're living in a liberal blue America, why is it that the Republicans are in the White House and in the majority on Capitol Hill? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about shifting political landscapes, specifically red and blue America. The war on terror and the prospect of a possible war in Iraq have boosted the conservative agenda, but can Republicans keep their power hold in Washington, or will they slip up? Is there a way for the Democrats to steer the political conversation back toward the liberal agenda? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Tom Edsel, political reporter with The Washington Post, and On Point analyst Jack Beatty. And I want to bring in Kellyanne Conway now. She's been standing by online, and she is CEO and president of the polling company in Washington. Hi, Kellyanne.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, and thanks for joining us. Let me ask you first how this lens of a morality gap works in terms of your mindset. Is it an accurate predictor of voter behavior?
To some extent, it is. It certainly is an accurate predictor of the values matrix that many voters either engage and consider in making their choices for elective office, or actually consider and then say, this isn't important to me, and so discount it altogether. This is an important piece that Tom Edsel, who, you know, in my mind is one of the finest journalists in the country, it's an important piece he's written. I think the most important thing from it, though, that I would emphasize, more important than really the sort of sexual aspect of the morality prism, is the religiosity aspect of the morality prism. We've seen, I've been in polling for 15 years, and we've seen this increasing bifurcation of America's voters depending on how frequently they attend religious services. And that is irrespective of what your religious affiliation is. So for years, pollsters were asking people the question, are you Catholic or Jewish or Muslim or agnostic or Christian or atheist, and not really getting at the nuance, which has showed us now that to talk about, quote, the Catholic vote or the Jewish vote or the Christian vote is disingenuous, because Orthodox Jews, devout church-going Catholics, not the Palm Sunday, Easter, Christmas Catholics, and evangelical church-going Christians think much more alike politically and ideologically than, say, Catholics who were baptized and never went back to church, along with those who do go to church at least once a week. So the aspect of the article that touches on what we refer to as devotion or religiosity is very important, and even that was manifested in the 2000 elections. It's also manifested in a place that I think we need to introduce in this conversation, which is it's manifested in turnout numbers. There's a huge difference, I think often lost in polling, between agreement and intensity. You can have a number of people agree with an idea or a phrase or a message in a survey or in casual conversation, you know, in the workplace or over a cappuccino counter, but it doesn't mean that they're going to run to the ballot box and feel engaged about that issue. That's where we find this sort of morality prism, these sexual ideals, taking on a different character election by election. I would argue that excesses bring out the masses to the polls. And what I mean by that is excesses energize voters. In 1994, the response to the liberal excesses of 1993 and 1994, Bill Clinton, health care, nationalization, gays in the military, all those things that really had alienated many in his own party, that brought about the Republican Revolution of 1994. And, you know, as far as the House of Representatives goes, the Democrats have never recaptured that majority. In 1998, what was perceived as the excesses from the Republican Party in making the big two election issues that year, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, something I, as a Republican strategist, was very set against, that brought out the response that we heard from many voters was, I'm going to reject that as well. That's excessive and that's irrelevant. I do think, though, that we have not had a presidential election yet where this idea of how important, how central your morality and your ideas on sexual liberty and whatnot, or sexual privacy, how central they are to your vote is really contingent on how central they are to your life. And 2004 is going to be a very different election because we will have had some type of war. We will have known the result by then, we hope. We'll know what the economy is doing then. It seems to me in 2000, if not 1996, people felt a little bit more free to probe these kinds of crevices in their mind, if you will. Now, we're talking the big boy issues. People are very focused on the war or random acts of terrorism, keeping their family safe, and they're very, very focused on kitchen table economics. So they probably lack a little bit more luxury to say, gee, I care and I'm not in agreement with this position, whether it's I believe in an unfettered right to an abortion, even up to the, you know, the, through the ninth month, or I believe that abortion is always wrong.
Kelly, let me stop you there. Yeah. You've made a lot of good points, but we have a lot of callers who also want to become part of the conversation. So let's go to Jim, who's standing by on the line. Hi, Jim.
Hi, and just want to say at the outset that I've really enjoyed Tom Edsel's previous books on politics of inequality and chain reaction, and looking forward to reading more of him on this subject. I had a point, I think, similar to the one that the pollster, whose name I didn't catch, was just making, having to do with how strongly people feel about issues and how salient they are. Because it seemed to me that in addition to this cluster of issues around sex and religion, that even if Republicans only got minorities whose positions were closer to them on those issues, that would be okay for them if they were also getting similar minorities that didn't overlap too much on things like gun ownership and race relations and American exceptionalism or nativism, and that putting strong minorities together on each of those clusters of things, together with their natural constituency of the most well-off, might still be enough to win elections, even in the absence of a big overhanging war issue.
Thanks so much for the call, Jim. Tom, you just heard from one of your fans. What's your response?
I think that's what both parties try to do, is to piece together a coalition. I think, though, that that these morality issues do define, in many ways, the base voter, and they do overlap. And I think guns also overlaps. The attitude towards guns coincides very much with these. And you find that on those kind of issues, when people take a stand on sexual morality issues, guns and religion, they go either to the left or to the right. And Kellyanne is absolutely right about religiosity being very important as a predictor. But they all tend to overlap, but I think they also tend to define the base. Then the battle becomes for people who are less intensely felt about these issues. We're trying to get them often on other issues or on a host of other matters.
Kellyanne, I want to get a comment from you as well, but I also want to ask about when you see figures that show that the numbers of people who go to church weekly appear to be dropping, does that concern you?
It concerns, I think it should concern anyone, but I think that they were artificially inflated after 9/11 and everybody was lighting candles and running to church and waving the flag. I mean, go to any reasonable wholesale or retail store and you'll see the flag basically on the 75% off discount tables, you know. So I do think for a while that patience was the new patriotism, and somehow that George W. Bush had converted the red versus blue country into red, white, and blue country, at least for a time. I think much of that has dissipated, and particularly as the drumbeat has continued about the war. But I will say that when people stop going to church or when that has dropped off, you need to overlay that with voter propensity. See, if fewer than half of us are actually participating in elections, and the numbers are sometimes less than 40% in non-presidential election years, then that's really what matters here. All the conversation, all the agreement, all the head nodding in the world doesn't matter if you don't feel energized enough to go to the ballot box, either out of frustration and disagreement with that point or to lend your support for it. Now, I think that turnout will increase in the future for a very simple reason. It's a heck of a lot easier to encourage people to go to the ballot box out of fear, frustration, anger, resentment, than it is to have them just go and pull the lever as a signal for attaboy. But the number of people who go to church is very correspondent to the number of people who feel politically active in some way. I also think the number of people who think religious services are not important or look at themselves as spiritual, not doctrinal, is increasing. You have a real secular spiritual revival in this country of sorts that is not doctrinal, that is not adherent to any type of scripture or formal worship, yet these people feel a sense that there's something bigger than them out there. And the last point I want to make about all this is, you know, our modern society also has allowed so many of us to choose where to live now more than ever, and I think that is reflected in some of these statistics that Tom has put in his piece and that other political observers have noted, ourselves included, in that years ago you were 21 and you got married and you were someone else's problem. You know, you just sort of nested where you were raised or your spouse was raised or with a college or military base where you could find a job, and you raised your children there and chances were they stay there. This is a very, very affluent and fluid society now. People choose to live in areas that they like and that are like them. So I think there's a lot more like-mindedness politically and ideologically for some of these things. Try to tell someone in Manhattan, where there are close to 200 Starbucks, that there are still four states in this country that don't have a single Starbucks. I mean, they'll think that you're talking about Mars. So we are a culturally a diverse country, and I think that is reflected not just in the way that we worship or don't worship, but also in the way that we behave at the ballot box.
Kellyanne, we want to go back to another caller now. Jillian is on the line. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, how are you? Yeah, I wanted to weigh in on this issue coming from a conservative perspective, but I actually agree with Tom's premise that the country is, we do vote according to sexual morality issues, but I disagree with his understanding of where the common people are at as being very liberal sexually. I actually believe that the average people still have generally conservative values regarding abortion, gay marriages, and so forth. But the media totally misrepresents where the common people are at. And so that's why we're voting conservatively, but the media just doesn't get it, that that's actually what people believe. And I really, for example, believe that's why Shannon O'Brien lost the election, because
in Massachusetts, you're referring
right
to.
Here in Massachusetts, she lost the election the day that she said she would lower the age of non-parental consent to 16 for abortions. And I know she lost a lot of people on that, because I know people who are devout Democrats, but they're conservative in their morality, blue-collar Catholic type people. When she said that, they were like, well, I can't vote for her then, you know, and they kind of maybe aren't into overturning Roe v. Wade. Maybe they're not that extreme, but they certainly don't want to lower the age of parental consent.
Okay, we take your point, Jillian. We thank you so much. Let's get a response quickly from Tom, and then I want to hear from Jack Beatty again.
To some extent, I agree with the caller, but I have to say that I think voters are tolerant. They're not necessarily liberal in their, sexual libertarians. But I think they do not want to have people imposing their values, whether they are sort of liberal social engineering kind of values that people opposed on busing and matters like that, or whether they are kind of Pat Robertson, Pat Buchanan kind of moral values that they felt were being imposed on them. And in recent years, there's been a shift, really, from the fear of the liberal imposition of social engineering values to the fear of basically religious right kind of values being imposed. And it's really more I think the general consensus is as opposed to the external imposition of a morality on you.
Jack?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on something Jillian said and to connect it with some data you've cited, Tom, in other articles, which is that this Democratic Party last time in 2000 captured the vote of Marin County by, I don't know, double digits. Marin County in California, very wealthy suburb of San Francisco. Meanwhile, George Bush carried a county, I think you said, in eastern Kentucky, where the median income was about $25,000. He carried that county by about 20 points. Now, in all candor, there isn't a thing in the world that George Bush is going to do for people earning that kind of money. In fact, he's not going to cut their taxes because many of them just pay in Social Security. But values somehow took people who, even in 1972, used to be Democratic voters. They voted for McGovern. And partly because Bush was able to make values seem, I will keep my pants on in the Oval Office. That's really what, you know, I will restore the honor and integrity of the office came down to. Partly because that, but also because he managed to make the Democrats look like these, you know, sleazy kind of modernizers of morality and sort of throwing it in people's faces. I mean, how do you explain that, Tom? I mean, can you build a winning coalition of Democrats on Marin County while losing this county where people earn $25,000 a year?
Well, I think, one, that those counties, there are a lot of eastern Kentucky and, Kentucky and West Virginia and Tennessee kind of counties that are heavily white, and but they're also very religious, for one thing. And there you do have a very high religiosity factor. People do attend church. Secondly, they are gun owners. And when they see a political party threatening their right to own a gun, which the Democratic Party has been portrayed as, that really contributes to things. And guns, religion, and they also, in those areas, tend to be anti-abortion. I mean, explicitly anti-abortion. So you've got a lot of values issues over and above just Bush's keeping his pants on in the Oval Office, playing to the advantage of the Republican Party in those areas.
Yeah, I would have to agree that, and I would add guns to that. I think that those pockets of Kentucky, and as we saw in Tennessee, Arkansas, and West Virginia as well, where Bush beat Gore in 2000, that the gun issue played very importantly. I mean, West Virginia alone, where Democratic Senator Bob Byrd was reelected with probably over 80% of the vote, the Republican nominee, the incumbent for governor, lost, yet Bush beat Gore. And I would also add that I don't know many people in this country, if any, who believe that Al Gore would not keep his pants on in the Oval Office. I don't think that was a problem for him at all. And in fact, he must be reading Tom Edsel and taking some good advice, because he did try to portray himself as sexually cool or liberated, if you will, by giving his wife sort of a 10-minute kiss, the famous kiss at the Democratic National Convention. But I think that was one area where Gore and Bush were on parity in voters' minds, was this whole idea that both of them would be, I don't know, faithful to their wives. I'm not so sure many voters really care about that.
Kellyanne, we have just about a minute or so before we need to take a break. Are you concerned at all that Republicans might overreach on some of these social and moral issues?
I'm always concerned about the party that I consult with and that I care about. Overreach is one problem. I think underreaching is another. I'm often concerned about underreach on issues that don't seem like the hot button, easy ones to cover and talk about, because we asked the question, we do the bipartisan polling for the hotline, the National Journal's hotline, and we asked the question along with the Democratic polling firm, open-ended, please tell us your most important issues, and the sum total of pro-choice on abortion, quote, gun control, campaign finance reform, you know, the sum total of these issues was less than 9% when people are just asked top of mind. So I worry that we engage too much in these debates and don't talk enough about the kitchen table economics issues that people are really focused on right now.
We're talking this hour about the shifting political landscape in America. Is it the conservative or liberal agenda that will rule in Washington over the long run? How do you cast your vote? On issues or values? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the shifting political landscape in America and about whether it's issues or values that decide how voters cast their ballots. We're talking this hour with Washington Post political reporter Thomas Edsel, with Republican pollster Kellyanne Conway, and with On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty. Let's go back to our phone lines. Mike's been standing by. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
What's on your mind tonight?
So I grew up in a very conservative place, and I always felt that the conservatives were constantly preaching about things like abortion or school prayer. If you didn't agree with them, you were wrong. And then I went to a liberal college, and I was surprised to find the liberals did exactly the same thing. If you didn't agree with them on affirmative action, you were racist. If you didn't agree with them on economic inequality, you were terribly oppressing the poor. And I'm wondering if this might happen on a national scale. Maybe if people who feel right now they're being preached to by the right wing will feel preached to again by the left wing if they get into power and start telling people that if you don't agree with us on affirmative action, for example, you are a racist. Is this possible?
Tom?
I think what the caller is describing is in somewhat in reverse what has taken place. I think through the 70s, the Democratic Party was seen as the preachy party, moralistic, that McGovern, Mondale, and Dukakis were all seen as kind of, they could have been Episcopalian ministers trying to impose values on other people. I think then in the 90s, the Republicans began to run into this same problem, especially in 92. What the caller is describing is a real phenomena. And often when the Republican Party has done particularly well is when, like on college campuses, is when they are the rebellious anti-establishment kind of party. And liberal establishments on college campuses have become vulnerable to this. Precisely what the guy says.
Kellyanne, a quick comment?
Yes, my quick comment is that this is precisely why so few people actually vote, for really the life experience that the caller has had. He first felt disaffected by one ideological group, then he felt disaffected by another. That's why many Americans really just disengage from the system altogether. I think what changes, though, is when you go through different stations in life. For example, we do a lot in the women's vote. We find that women on college campuses are, quote, liberal or libertine. Then they start getting the four magic M's, marriage, mortgage, munchkins, and mutual funds, and they start to look at the world very politically differently. And I think even Tom's analysis, as it is shown in the Atlantic Monthly, would support that as people sort of change in their lives, they become more or less enamored of sexual freedom or sexual privacy, and then maybe the pendulum swings back the other way.
Jack, we only have a couple of minutes here. Looking ahead to 2004, how do you think this is all going to play out?
The short answer is I don't know. I'm not supposed to say that, but I don't. But, you know, this era reminds me of another one, the 1920s. Then, too, you had a politics of values. Arthur Schlesinger Sr. wrote a book called The Vanishing Voter in 1924. It could be written about today. Low turnout, politics of values built around moral issues, city versus country, red versus blue. But then the politics of interest returned with a vengeance with the Great Depression, and politics was realigned. I still think that in America, the politics of interest is what ultimately shapes alignments and realignments, and that in some sense, American politics is waiting now for the deciding recession, for the event, for the economic downturn, or the economic playing out of a dangerous economic logic that will return politics to interest and away from values. I think these things go in pendulum, and I think we're due for a return of the politics of interest.
And again, depending, of course, on how a war goes, if there is one. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Jack Beatty and also with Kellyanne Conway, a Republican pollster, CEO, and president of the Polling Company in Washington. Also with Tom Edsel, who joined us from Delaware, Ohio. He's a political reporter with the Washington Post. And you can read Tom Edsel's piece from the Atlantic Monthly, Blue Movie, The Morality Gap is Becoming the Key Variable in American Politics. Thanks so much for being here, Tom.
Thank you.
And we can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In just a moment, On Point's movie maven, Garen Daly, on films that make men cry. Yes, he says they do. This is On Point. Everyone knows that real men don't cry, or do they? New research shows that American men do cry, perhaps more than the men in any other country in the world. Sometimes men cry for different reasons than women. They cry over their relationships with their dads, over honor and redemption, and they cry over sports. Hollywood has known for years that tearjerkers are not the exclusive purview of women. Movies like the 1952 classic Shane have been pulling at men's heartstrings for years.
Come back!
On Point movie maven Garen Daly is here now with a look at the movies that make men cry. Welcome, Garen.
Hi, Gail.
And who doesn't remember that scene? It was heartbreaking.
It was a great scene, and it's become part of our cultural heritage now. I mean, we were actually making fun of this scene in some films, but, you know, seeing Alan Ladd riding off with that wound in his side, a little Brandon in the Wild with a tear streaming down his face, it's just grabs you.
But who knew that you men were sitting there in the audience with your hankies out?
Well, we don't have our hankies. We don't have hankies. We just kind of sniffle, you know, move our eyes quickly to, you know, our hands to our eyes and kind of cover it up very quickly. But, you know, this is something that, you know, we as men, we do it. We do. We go to the movies because it's a safe place. We can be vulnerable in the movies. And it's interesting to note that when you take a look at the films that men cry at, they're very predictable. You know what the plot is. And I think the reason that is that it allows men the ability not to focus on what's going to happen on the screen, but to feel what's happening on the screen. And being able to, like, feel and release emotions in a darkened theater, it's a safe haven, much differently than if you were in your office crying. But doing it inside a movie theater, you're given a little bit of leeway.
Even in war movies.
Even in war movies. And I have to tell you, when I saw Saving Private Ryan, I can't believe how much I was affected by the death of Tom Hanks in that film. We meet this wonderful, courageous guy who goes through the invasion of Normandy, and you learn about what a caring, decent person he is and that he's taking care of his platoon. And ultimately, when he makes that sacrifice to save Private Ryan, it is incredibly moving and touching, and it still brings a tear to my eye, even when I start talking about it, let alone listening to it.
What, sir?
Yes. Ernest.
Well, it certainly reminds you of the sacrifices that happened on the battlefield.
Yeah, and again, Tom Hanks does such a wonderful job of conveying not only his decency and the fact that he's a normal guy, so that anyone in the audience of a movie theater can relate and really just project themselves right onto the screen. It's really an important part of what makes that scene work and what makes that film work.
And what about some of the classics?
Well, in the classics, there are a lot of films that, especially in the 30s, talked about the honor aspect of things, how people would make sacrifice for their friends. And in Ronald Coleman and Tale of Two Cities, we see Dickens transposed to the screen where he does make that sacrifice, where he puts himself in place so that he is going to die at the guillotine rather than his friend. He's redeeming himself and sacrificing himself at the same time. Two very important elements that men like. So who can forget those final scenes as he's getting ready to be killed?
You're going to die in this place. Why?
He is my friend. It's a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done. It's a far, far better rest I go to than I have ever known.
Well, Garen, don't you think anyone, man or woman, would like to be that brave?
Well, you would like to be that brave, hopefully. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of, again, people or men watching these films are hoping that they're able to be that brave, to be able to make that sacrifice. You never know when it's going to be called upon for you to make that kind of sacrifice. Sports films, I think, are almost unique unto this genre of what make films that make men cry, because they are very predictable. We know what the score is going to be at the end of the game. So it is not a question of what the score is, but what does the score mean? And in a lot of films, in particular Hoosiers, which we're going to hear a clip from in a second, we're talking about a man who needs to be redeemed, a coach who has been banned, a drunkard who needs to reestablish himself with a family. And then there's the star of the game. The star of the game is a guy by the name of Jimmy Chitwood. And in Hoosiers, the climax comes when the town wants to get rid of the coach, played by Gene Hackman, and this young basketball player comes in to the town hall, which looks like a church, and makes a sacrifice and makes an announcement.
I play, coach stays. He goes, I go.
All those in favor of the coach staying, say aye.
Aye!
Those opposed?
Nay!
Coach stays.
So redemption there, Garen, and also standing up for what you think is right.
Again, these are two very important themes that men identify with because it is all about honor. And I think part of the honor question is making sure that you know what your place is when you are challenged in a certain way and when you are challenged by a loss or an unresolved issue. And this comes particularly with fathers and sons. For instance, in Field of Dreams, we have Kevin Costner trying to resolve the issue of what his relationship with his father was. And he doesn't do it until he builds a ballpark in the middle of an Iowa field. And then not only does Shoeless Joe Jackson come out of heaven and come to his ballpark, but all these other players and his father.
Is there a heaven?
Oh, yeah. It's the place dreams come true.
Maybe this is heaven.
Hey, Dad? You want to have a catch?
I'd like that.
Oh, Garen, I'm getting teary just remembering that scene.
You know, I'm also kind of reminded of Tom Hanks in A League of Her Own saying, there's no crying in baseball, but there is. And Kevin Costner does it, and he gets everyone in the theater crying along with him on that particular scene. And remember, this is a classic American male bonding thing with father and son where they don't talk. They toss the baseball, and that's how they bond together. Tossing a baseball. Action rather than words.
Although sometimes what they do is hug.
What sometimes they do is hug. And that's something new. And I think what's happened in American culture and in American movies is that for many years, women have been telling guys, you know, release your emotions. Therapists have been saying, release your emotions. So in 1980, Robert Redford did it in Ordinary People when he got Timothy Hutton, who plays the son who's very troubled, and Donald Sutherland, who plays the father who wants to help his son become whole again. And the only way they can do it is by being very frank and actually expressing themselves in words and touching each other in that way.
You always made us feel like everything was going to be all right. I really admire you for it.
I don't admire people too much. They'll disappoint you sometimes.
I'm not disappointed. I love you.
I love you, too.
Well, Garen, I think you've persuaded us we should all go to the movies and just have ourselves a good cry.
Well, I think we need to go there every once in a while. You know, it's funny. You watch George Bush cry after 9/11. You see Curtis Martin, a football player, crying after he signs a big paycheck. But, you know, I remember when Ed Muskie cried and lost a primary. And I think that's the thing that is different these days, is that we've grown accustomed that men can cry. But for an ordinary guy like me, it's not going to be crying at the office. It's going to be crying when the lights are down and the scenes are flickering on the screen.
Thanks so much, Garen.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly is artistic director at the Dedham Community Theater and is On Point's movie maven.
I won't cry. I won't cry. No, I won't shed a tear just as long as you stand by me.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is WBUR.